You're listening to the WGBH Forum Network Current Events Podcast. Each week, we'll bring you the perspectives of leading professors, economists, policymakers, authors, and community leaders on the topics affecting your daily life. It's a chance to dig deeper into today's hot-button issues: politics, economics, U.S. and world events, and more. The Forum Network is a service of WGBH. Our website contains thousands of video and audio lectures on a variety of subjects. Stop by and explore a world of ideas at wgbh.org/forum.
Good afternoon, and thank you for coming to this event hosted by the Center for Policy Studies and Department of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. It is our great pleasure to welcome John Zaller, Professor of Political Science at UCLA, to our campus today. John is, to my mind, probably the leading scholar of public opinion in the United States at the moment. I was talking with my colleague Justin Buechler and explaining to somebody about the about his book being, and I said, his famous book, The Nature and Origins of Mass Opinion, and and saying, well, you know, most, you know, lots of political scientists assign it in their classes on public opinion, and Justin's comment was, well, no, actually, everybody assigns it in their classes on public opinion. John is also the co-author of The American Ethos: Public Attitudes Towards Capitalism and Democracy, and of The Party Decides: Presidential Nominations Before and After Reform, and in his work on parties. That work on parties has been cited widely during the discussions of the current nomination process to try to explain the trends and on the Republican side. And the talk he's going to give today, to my mind, bridges these two questions, because what he's basically going to talk about is the changing nature, or the nature over time that has been not so necessarily understood, of American political parties, and in particular the role of ideology in political parties. And I've been looking forward to hearing what he had to say on this topic since he agreed to come and talk. And therefore, I am going to shut up and turn it over to Professor John Zaller.
Hey, thank you, Joe. Joe and I are friends from graduate school at Berkeley, and I'm really glad to be able to come to his place and give a talk for his people. Thank you, Joe, for having me. I want to say, though, it's also to some extent my place. My father studied at Case Institute of Technology after World War II. Helped study with a guy who was inventing photoelasticity as a technique for airplane design. And I, another reason I feel like Cleveland is my place is because my grandparents, when they migrated to the United States, came to Cleveland and set up the Collinwood Bakery about 1910, and I think it ran until sometime in the 1960s. And still another reason why I feel it's my place is because a lot of my relatives are here. Three of them two of them anyway, are here, and maybe the third one will walk in, Zollers. From way back. So thank you. Oh, and I also want to tell you what a great city you have. My aunt gave me a great tour of this place, and it's really an unappreciated gem. You guys are pretty lucky to have this place. My topic today is party and ideology. There's four audiences that you could, I guess, speak to. I usually speak to students, undergraduate students. This morning I spoke for the first time in my life to high school students. That was different, and I had to really think hard to change gears. Another audience is professional professors, professional peers. I spoke yesterday in New York to an audience of professors. And so now I have mostly a lay audience, so I'm going to have to, like, I hope I get this right. The subject is party and ideology. It's a collaborative project. It's work done. It's not working. Can't get my next slide. You said push down that. Oh, this one. There we go. Okay, so it's a collaborative project with a bunch of people. The main source of the talk today is the paper, Theory of Political Parties, by those six people. The four in the middle are former UCLA graduate students that are in the places that you see. Kathy Bond and I are still at UCLA. It's also going to draw on a book and a paper and book in progress called The Coalition Merchants by Hans Noel, who's also contributed to the first one. And it's also going to draw a little bit from a paper called Constructing Us, a paper about ideology by Kathy. And then I feel like I have somewhere in there I've made a contribution. I've been talking to these guys. We've been working together on these things, though they have primary credit for some of the stuff. So, but it's mostly, I'd like to say, a collaborative thing. And I better say that there's got to be some original content. And if they would hear about this, I'm sure that they would have some disagreements with me, and those would be my original contributions to the project. So, what we're trying to understand most fundamentally is democracy. Which there's a famous political scientist, E.E. Schatzschneider, who said democracy is unthinkable save for parties. There are really no democracies in the world that don't have political parties doing their partisan bickering thing, but structuring politics for voters. But the question is, what is a party? And there's a standard view in political science, which is that a party is a team of politicians whose aim is to gain office in elections. That is really the only view of parties, I would say, that is in, well, I'm sure there are other views someplace, but that's the standard view, the dominant view. And the six of us co-authors are working to develop an alternative view, which we think is a better fit not only to contemporary American parties, but to parties throughout American history, and maybe a fit to parties in Europe. So, and in arguing this view, I'll just mention we're trying to change the way political science as a whole changes, thinks about this very fundamental institution of political parties. Democracy is unthinkable, would say, for parties, but what is a party? And we're going to say it is fundamentally something different than the standard view. So our view is that a party is a coalition of interest groups and activists, not a coalition primarily of politicians, that seeks to nominate and elect politicians, that is, choose them, to choose politicians committed to their joint purposes, and that they are the powers in parties and not the politicians. If you believe our view of things, you come out with party, if you believe the standard view, parties and their politicians are loyal primarily to voters. They just want to gain office. That means they just want to please voters. If you believe our story, their primary loyalty is to the groups that nominated them. So that's the question. What is the loyalty of the politicians? To the people who nominate them or to the people who elect them? And it's a difficult question because they have to keep both groups satisfied. But our claim is that their primary loyalty is to the people who nominate them, to the what we call the intense policy demanders that are active in the nomination process. The standard view, so I'll give you the standard view here. Those of you who are political scientists probably recognize Anthony Downs' Economic Theory of Democracy. His argument, which is a stripped down, very spare theory of democracy that has politicians and parties in it. He says that politicians are people who only care about gaining office, don't care at all about policy, and form parties to compete for office. And they compete in left-right space, so on a liberal-conservative continuum. So there'll be one party on the left and one party on the right. But Downs claims that the pressures of political competition lead both parties to move to the center. In fact, all the way to the center, to the point where it's difficult to tell one party from the other. And it's pretty obvious that that hasn't completely happened in American politics. But people still use the Downsian framework as a kind of a standard against which to evaluate parties. And we would argue that that is an inappropriate standard, that a better standard would be a party system in which the primary loyalty of the politicians is to their nominators. Now, there's I'm going to talk about some of the standard literature on parties. One of them is a book called Setting the Agenda by Gary Cox and Matt McCubbins. And I think that the main thing that I'll say about it is that they claim that the majority party in Congress organizes to control the agenda of the Congress for the sake of creating a brand name that will appeal to the voters and help the incumbent, the majority party politicians, to get reelected. So these, in the Cox and McCubbins view, politicians do have views, unlike Anthony Downs's views, but their primary aim is to create this brand name. And in order to do this, they engage in some tactics that many citizens are unaware of. They do them all the way out in the open, but they to control the agenda. For example, right now the Republican Party has about 240 members of the House of Representatives against about 190 Democrats. On important legislation, the Republican caucus in the House of Representatives will meet by itself, not in that great room that you've all visited, but they'll meet in their caucus room and they'll decide among themselves what they would like to do. Then they will charge staff to write legislation. Then they will review that legislation. When they're satisfied with it, they'll bring it to the floor of the House of Representatives for a vote, in which no amendments, or only amendments that have no chance of passing, are allowed. So they will completely dominate the agenda and set the agenda on important legislation. That's a little bit of an overly simplified statement, but that's basically what the Republicans are doing right now, and also basically what the Democrats do when they have a majority in the House of Representatives, and which they've had at various points in the past, to control the agenda. They do this, according to Cox and McCubbins, in order to create a brand name that will make the party popular. The party can only pass its own program. Party wants to pass its own program and can't pass its own program if it leaves it open to amendment. But one of the things about the party, each party's program when they're in power, is it's not usually a centrist program. It's a right-wing program when the Republicans are in power and a left-wing program when the Democrats are in power. And by controlling the agenda, by not allowing amendments or restricting amendments, they can prevent somebody from the other party from amending the party program to a centrist position. So by controlling the agenda, disallowing amendments, they're able to keep a party platform. Each party is able to keep its agenda far from the center of public opinion, where most voters are in the center. So this is a very significant thing that the parties do, and according to Cox and McCubbins, they do it just to keep up a good brand name so they can get reelected. There's another book called Why Parties, and I think I will just leave it with the signature statement: the major political party is the creature of the politicians and the ambitious office seekers and office holders. So that's just a strong statement that the party apparatus, the party institutions, including the legislative institutions that I just described, are the creature of the politicians, who are ambitious office seekers and mostly just trying to get elected. So those are, I think, especially the Aldrich book, are the leading theoretical statements in political science today about what parties are. Aldrich does say that ideological activists in the parties pressure the politicians to adopt extreme positions, but he goes on, the politicians are the actual leaders of the parties, and as actual leaders, their main aim is to appeal to the voters and get reelected. So, let's see here. So I want to make some critical comments about the standard view. Critical is not always negative. The first one is positive. These parties can be truly said to be good for democracy. Politicians are organizing, just trying to do what the voters want so that they can get themselves reelected. Parties are good for democracy, these parties. But I have also some critical negative comments. One is, where do these politicians come from? There aren't any strong statements in this theory about how politicians get nominated. They just sort of appear. These ambitious politicians appear and start running for office. And I think that that's a shortcoming in the theory that it doesn't have a strong account of how nominations occur. The reason that it doesn't have much of a statement is because political scientists probably know less about nominations than the NASA scientists know about the surface of the moon. Even though it's right under our noses, political scientists don't know almost anything about congressional nominations, and not that much actually about presidential nominations. They're beneath the radar of most voters and beneath the radar of political scientists. The other critical comment is these parties and politicians appear to enjoy autonomy from society's main interest groups and activists. And that could be true. Parties might exist just as autonomous forces apart from the major interests in society, but it's a question whether they are or not. And we are going to talk about primary parties in a way that roots them very directly in the interests of the society. So our alternative view. The kind of pillar of our view is that voters are ineffective in monitoring government performance. And that's not to say that they can't see anything, that they can't monitor at all, but there are great limitations in what they're able to monitor and hold politicians accountable for. First of all, there's a lot of what government does, which is just detailed regulation. How much smoke can be emitted by factories, how much logging can go on in the national forests, that kind of stuff. Voters aren't interested. It's way below their radar. But even major government policies are often not effectively monitored by the voters. I mean, in the sense that the government can do whatever the government considers wise, and the voters are not going to punish them. So I'll give you two examples of major policies where the government office holders had a great deal of discretion. The first one is the Iraq War. George W. Bush won the election of 2000 by 517 votes, I think it was. And I think it's very likely that if Al Gore had gotten 518 more votes than he did, that Al Gore would have been president and there would have been no Iraq War. The voters did not punish George Bush for having the Iraq War. They would not, I believe, have punished Al Gore for not having the Gulf War. That war was a war that was at the discretion or the judgment of the government, and I don't mean this in a cynical way. George W. Bush's judgment was that was a good war, but it wasn't one that was demanded by public opinion, and it wasn't one that the public complained about afterwards either, and it could have been the same for Gore if he had won. You might say that foreign policy is extraordinary, but my second example would be the Bush tax cuts. There were very large tax cuts, two of them, two rounds of tax cuts in the first George Bush administration. If you asked people in polls, did they favor tax cuts, they would say that they did. And yes, if it's yes or no, we want yes, a tax cut. If there was a lot of polling on that subject, however, and the thrust of that polling was that about a quarter of the, there had been, let me back up, the Clinton administration had a large budget surplus, a $200 billion budget surplus, which the Bush administration inherited. And there was a lot of talk and a lot of public opinion polling on what that $200 billion surplus should be done with it. And so some people said, give it all back. Some people said, use it to retire the debt. Some people said, use it to shore up Medicare and Social Security or to improve education. Only about a quarter of them wanted all of the money to be given back in the form of a tax cut. And in the presidential election debates, Gore and Bush debated that, and Bush at that time was promising to give back only about a third of it. What he gave back was not only the tax cut, he gave back not only all of the surplus, but about twice the surplus, much larger than most voters wanted, than almost any voters wanted. And the response of the voters was, thank you. The people were not following the debates closely enough to keep track of all of those zeros and the billions and trillions and tens of trillions of dollars. And so that was at the discretion of the government. The Republicans who were running the government, it was their judgment that that tax cut would be good for the country and just. And although it wasn't something that the voters asked for, it wasn't something that they punished either. It was at the discretion of the government. So another thing that creates a large amount of discretion for the government is the influence of the economy on the vote. You're all aware that an incumbent president is more likely to be reelected if the economy is strong. So that's a problem for Obama right now. There's a good chance that he won't be reelected unless the economy improves. And that explains about 50% of variation in presidential election outcomes, the economy. The economy independent of any policy. So politicians can do, office holders can do whatever they judge best. And there's a good chance that a good economy is going to get them reelected, whether the voters, even if the voters disliked it, or that a bad economy will get them thrown out of office, even if the voters did like it. So again, there's a large area where the politicians, the office holders, are free to act at their discretion in their own judgment that the voters will not be able to hold them accountable for. As we argue, there's a large blind spot in the voters' vision of politics. Which is not to say, and I want to emphasize this, which is not to say that the voters will allow anything whatsoever. We recently had three examples of policies where parties didn't do what they wanted to do, politicians didn't do what they wanted to do because they thought the voters were watching. So the most recent one was President Obama proposed to, as part of his health care program, to require Catholic hospitals to dispense birth control and contraception supplies. And everybody thought, even people who use birth control and think that it's a good thing, they thought that that was just kind of gross to make the Catholics do that. Let people get their birth control somewhere else, many people thought. And the Obama administration almost immediately backed down. That was something the public could understand. They knew what was going on there. They had feelings about it, and the politician backed off. Another example: this was a backdown that was so quick and swift you might have missed it. But the Republicans in Congress have been opposed to unemployment benefit extensions, and Tea Party members of the Republican Party, in particular, very strongly opposed to that. And if you remember, they've been fighting Obama on almost everything he wants to do in the area of the economy, and they were prepared to fight the unemployment extension. But they decided not to. They just said, wait, this is going to be a losing issue for us in an election. Let's just keep our heads down. Let's win the election, and then we'll think about that. So that was a case where we know what the Republicans would like to do, but they just said we're not going to contest it right now. Now, they may change their mind and contest it again, but for right now, they have backed down on something that in their judgment, that unemployment should not be extended. Another example is the senior drug benefit that George W. Bush passed in 2003. Extending Medicare, a major new entitlement for drug benefit for senior citizens, is not the Republican ideology. They mostly favor small government and cutting benefits, but they increased benefits for senior citizens in 2003. Why did they do that? Well, they didn't tell me personally, but I'm gonna say that it's because going into the 2000 election, they saw that it was going to be a very close election, that they were going to need absolutely every last vote that they could get. Seniors are organized. Seniors pay attention, especially to senior issues. And George W. Bush did not want to be debating Al Gore and have to say, no, the seniors need to do that one on their own. He wanted to say, no, we're going to provide a senior benefit that's going to be just as good as the Democrats. And then, having promised, President Bush kept his word and delivered that. So that was an example of where a pivotal group in a pivotal state was watching, was organized, and cared, and got the politicians to respond. So I'm not saying that the politicians never respond. I'm saying to public opinion. I'm saying that there's a large area of discretion, which I can't describe it in a general way, but I can just say it's big. And that's what politicians can do at their own discretion, independent of elections. So why am I going into this? if there's something that the politicians can do that the voters can't monitor and can't control, well, somebody's going to want to try and get hold of that. And that's the interest groups and the activists, what we call the intense policy demanders, people who care very strongly about abortion one way or the other, or rights for African Americans or women's or gays one way or the other, or the regulation of the economy or the size of government benefits one way or the other. While many voters are not watching or watching carefully, there are groups of activists and interest groups that are watching extremely carefully. And there's this big like pot of policy sitting there. And how do they get it? That's what they ask themselves. So there might be two ways that they could get it. One is they could just let the political system work, and after the politicians get elected, they could go lobby them, could go into, you know, George W. Bush gets elected, he's president, and the representatives of the senior citizens can go into him and say, please give us a giant drug benefit. And the president might do that, or he might not. It's at his discretion. He's the president. He doesn't really have to do anything he doesn't want to do, as I just explained. And he's in a very powerful position. So that's one thing they could do. The other thing that they could do is they could choose the politicians at the nomination stage. And it just makes a lot of sense that would be something that they would try and do, and it's our argument that that is what they try and do.
But there's a problem there, because if they can't monitor politicians, how do they know that they're going to deal with the
executive? That's an excellent question. What they try to do is to select at the nomination stage. They have a selection of politicians, and they try to get someone who actually genuinely shares their values. And I think that George W. Bush is my favorite on this case. I think that he looks like he personally believed in all of the elements of the Republican program. And I think the various interest groups and activists in the Republican Party could see that he did, and that he was just an excellent guy, that they could all trust him. And what the groups try to do at the nomination stage is to look very carefully at these candidates and determine whether they can trust them. Because you're right, they can't monitor them. Once the person is president of the United States, well, they can monitor him, but he's the president. And the congressman also can hide out and weasel out of things if they want to. So the goal of these groups at the nomination stage is to nominate people who have at least a history of commitment to the party program, and if possible, just a convincing personal commitment to it. And I think that George W. Bush had that. I think most Democrats felt that both Obama and Hillary Clinton had that in 2006, but we've just seen their whole Republican process, the 2008 process, that's been their big problem. They don't trust Romney. He's in many ways their best candidate, but because of he doesn't have a long enough history of commitment to their program, so they were very, very upset. In the end, they have selected him, but he's an example of who they don't want to accept most of the time. They had a field that didn't have in it anybody that would be ideally committed to their, as deeply committed as they would want, and so that was what made it a difficult process for them. And sometimes it's Santorum was committed to parts of the program, certainly the social conservatism aspect of it, but not so much to the economic. And also, they need a certain level of competence. And he didn't have the demonstrated level of competence. You got to be, there's not that many people who can run for president and not put their foot in their mouth all the time. It's easy for us to laugh at them for doing it, but if any of us would try to do it, it wouldn't be pretty. So it takes a very high level of skill to be able to do it, and also the policy commitment. It's actually a slightly tough problem when you've got a fairly tough problem when you've got a very diverse party. The Republican Party is now a big tent party, not entirely, to everyone's liking, but they're electing people in Massachusetts and New York City. And they had Rudy Giuliani last time, who was a very good politician. He's a tough guy, wasn't going to put his foot in his mouth, but to get elected from New York City, he had to violate elements of the national Republican program, which made him ineligible to be president, to represent, because they didn't trust him even more than they didn't trust Romney. So finding these politicians that they can trust at the nomination stage, at the national level, is not especially easy for a diverse party. But what they're trying to do is to find someone with a genuine genuine commitment, or at least a record of commitment, and the same for Congress. So we say our model of how nominations work is that candidates come from activist and interest, I'm thinking mostly of Congress now, from activist and interest group communities, and must, as a condition for nomination, accept the agenda of the coalition. And in Congress, at the level of Congress, it's easier to find people who are truly committed to your program because it's a more homogeneous place. It doesn't have to have Texas and Massachusetts and Oregon, you know, types of people. And if a local exception has to be made for in a Republican congressional district in Massachusetts, they'll make it and nobody will complain about it in Massachusetts. So it's probably easier to find people who are genuinely committed, but not completely easy, even then. And the, as I say, the candidates must be acceptable to all of the group members, which can be tricky. And that's what the Romney nomination shows. So the interest groups want to get control at that stage. An important element of this, which I thought I wrote onto my slides, but it doesn't seem to be there. I hope I didn't bring up the wrong set of slides. An important element is there's a lot of interest groups, and only one candidate can be nominated. So what these groups have to do is they have to form coalitions. Coalitions are people who have different interests, want different things, but can work together in a coalition. So they can't have conflicting things. They can't, you know, my gain is your loss. They have to have interests that are orthogonal. And if they can work together to work together in a coalition, then they can nominate someone that's acceptable to all of them and maybe truly committed to all of their values and send that person on to Congress. And I mentioned that they must the candidates must accept the agenda of the coalition. In today's party system, liberal and conservative are shorthand summaries for the group and activist agendas to which politicians must subscribe if they want to be nominated for office. So the I think I have here the nut of our program is of our argument is that activist and interest group communities capture politicians wholesale. That is, by wholesale, I mean like all across the country. You have a coalition, a conservative coalition or a liberal coalition, all across the country. They're nominating the same type of the politicians with the same commitments, so that then when they went and they go to Congress, you don't have to lobby 435 separate congressmen or a majority 219 separate congressmen. You're nominating them wholesale across the country, committed to your party, to your coalition agenda, and you get them when they're weak. When there's five or six of them who don't have an office and they'd like to have this office, you get to choose, and the voters aren't paying much attention at all, especially congressional elections. They're paying almost no attention. Whoever has the most money is just going to win, most likely. And even at the presidential elections, you know, we've been reading about the nomination contest, but voter turnout in these things is like 5, 10, 15%. Even for a presidential nomination, the voters are not paying very much attention. And so that creates an opportunity for the people who care a lot, want to work for those candidates, and donate money to them to get who they want. So that's our alternative view. Critical comments on this. These parties cannot be said to be good for democracy. They, or at least not obviously so, I'll make a comment about how some of the good that they do for democracy, and maybe enough, maybe you'll be pleased with them. But these parties do not sound good for democracy as we've theoretically described them. But we have some problems too. One of them is where do these group-centered parties come from? Is it realistic to believe that diverse interest groups and activists all around the country could somehow form a coalition that would be able to nominate candidates all across the country committed to that party coalition? It's not obvious that they could do that. I didn't stress it when I was talking about the standard view, but that view stresses the parties originate in Congress. So if you got like 435 people under one room, in one big room, you know, they can divide off and organize themselves into parties, and then, having organized in the legislature, go out into the country. But it's a big country for a coalition to form in, and it's not obvious at the outset that that could happen. And the third thing that's a critical point, I think a point of weakness or concern anyway for our theory, is that we claim that groups dominate politicians, but there's no evidence, not even impressionistic evidence, that this is so. You don't see a union come out and say, hey, this is the auto workers' candidate for president. They stay deeply behind the scenes, and you don't see it. And so maybe you don't see it because it's not there. We say they don't see it. We don't see it because these groups are inherently not that popular. Nobody loves a special interest of any kind. And it's one of the things that I think is most striking is the Christian conservatives do not name their groups. We're the Christian conservatives, or activists for Christ, or anything like that when they come into politics. They call themselves the Family Values Coalition. They appeal to things of more general interest when they show their heads at all. But mostly they don't show their heads. They stay behind the scenes. The candidates do meet these people. They are in regular phone conversation with them. They're in fundraisers with them all the time. But we don't see it. And you kind of have to infer that there must be something going on in all those phone calls and all of those fundraising meetings that's really important. But political scientists don't get an opportunity to see it. They're closed to the press and closed to political scientists. And we're left to infer that really important things are going on in those kinds of settings, but we don't see it, and that's a problem for us. In the end, you got to have evidence. You can't just say, I have a theory that this happens. You have to somehow demonstrate, provide evidence that's consistent with it. So what do we have for evidence? Scholars, political scientists, have made little effort to create and test alternatives to the standard view. Instead, they just work within the dominant paradigm. They haven't really considered alternatives. So there's not very much evidence. And as I've already said, nominations in particular are very far beneath the radar. And these meetings between the candidates and the various interest groups at the nomination stage are way beneath the radar. We got a little glimpse of one of those meetings in the 2008 election, where somebody turned on a tape recorder at one of Obama's fundraising speeches, talking in San Francisco to liberal activists and trying to show him that he was one of them. So he was making fun of the Democrats in West Virginia who were clinging to their guns and their Bibles, and it was a major embarrassment to him. So that's just a little glimpse we get inside of these things, where the politicians are talking to their people. They're trying to bond with them. They're trying to convince them, I'm one of you. And they don't want to broadcast what they have to say out to the whole public, because they want those relationships with their interest group and activist backers to remain private. And they do remain private. Sorry? The pledge is an example of something that is public. Grover Norquist has this pledge where he has all Republican candidates sign this pledge. So that's an example of one that's done out in the open. He's been very successful in maneuvering Republican candidates for Congress to sign this pledge that they won't raise taxes. I think there are a lot more pledges around and promises made than that one. That's an example of one, yes, but I think it's unusual in that it is so public. But it's not unusual in the sense I think there are a lot of them like that, a lot of pledges that are made. Excuse me. Poster child evidence, you know, just sort of anecdotal evidence. The anecdotal evidence is, I'll give one on both sides, the Romney nomination. It's not obvious that groups had anything to do with that. I mean, it looks like it was something between Romney and the voters. Debate performances, especially in South Carolina, were very important. It's not obvious that there were any behind-the-scenes backers for Romney. You can kind of infer that we'll be able to see where he got his money from. You kind of infer that Wall Street has been a big backer of him. Social conservatives were not. It's not obvious the groups controlled that nomination. On the other hand, a piece of evidence where I think you can't see it, but you can taste it, with the House Republicans and their very staunch opposition to any form of spending, and their very, very strong wish to lower taxes, even at the expense of changing the character of Medicare. And conventional politicians and journalists are saying, those guys, those House Republicans, those Tea Party Republicans, they're, you know, quote, crazy. What's the matter with them? Well, what's the matter with them is that they have been nominated by these Tea Party activists that we've been reading about over the last few years, or if not nominated by Tea Party activists, afraid of those Tea Party activists. Because even incumbents can be beaten in primaries easily, well, fairly easily, by not easily, fairly easily, if some organized group comes after them. And so those Republicans, what the Republicans are, who are wanting to cut, to make some of the cuts that they want to make, are, I would say, more, not crazy at all, just more worried about winning nomination and holding nomination than winning re-election. As you probably know, probably a majority of congressional districts, maybe even two-thirds, are safe. And sometimes the general election isn't going to matter for very much. But the less the general election matters, the more the primary election matters. So I don't know. But if you want to have an explanation for those, for the behavior of the Republicans in Congress, I would bet that they are thinking about activists who might want to come after them in their primaries. You know, Joe, I'm not sure how much farther I should go on. I feel like I've got the big ideas out. I might be best at this point to.
I think your basic point, if I understand from chatting with you earlier, is how ideology helps coordinate, and how the creation of ideology helps coordinate. Solve the problem you identify as to how the groups coordinate with each other outside of Congress.
Okay, so I'll talk. I just skipped over a lot of material, and I guess I will go to the party and ideology section. So what is ideology, and how does that work? I think I'll give you an example. And some of you may remember, it may be in your living memories. Not that long ago, about 70 years ago, the Democratic Party was the party of the White South and the Northern Catholics. It did not include a civil rights agenda. It was it wasn't very economically progressive either. Franklin Roosevelt's election and administration, the New Deal, made the party economically liberal, but it didn't do anything on the subject of race. It turned a blind eye to Southern segregation. That was because the White South, representatives of the White South, were dominant members in the Democratic Party in the 1930s and 1940s. But by 1964, the Democratic Party had somehow become the party of civil rights. That was a tremendously large, a huge transformation of American politics. How did the party of the White South become the party of civil rights over a period of about 30 years? Well, a number of people have studied this. And I'll just describe some of the research and then summarize it in terms of the themes of my talk. So one is this, one of our co-authors, Hans Noel, has written a paper called The Coalition Merchants. And he argues that political intellectuals and pundits create ideological coalitions by their writings. So people like Paul Krugman and David Brooks and people who write in the New Republic and the National Standard and those kinds of people write about politics in a way that makes certain ideas go together. So the people who were, and he is studying in particular the period, actually Hans studied what you might call pundit speak from 1850 to 1990. And he, at 20-year intervals, he would read essentially all the pundit speak that he could find. And he would look and say, what issues are going together? What are the coalitions that seem to be implicitly present in the pundit dialogue? And so as of 1910, there were a group of people who were economically progressive and another group who were economically conservative, but they had nothing to say about race. When he looks in 1930, he finds that the people who are economically progressive in places like the New Republic and the Nation were also racially liberal for the first time. So race had somehow been, well, not somehow, the people, they just had been brought into the pundit liberal coalition. And so people who would be reading then, so the liberals of their day, who would be reading The New Republic and The Nation for economic stuff would be suddenly getting a bunch of racial liberalism. And his argument is that that created a new liberal ideology, a group of activists who were committed not only to economic liberalism, but what we would today call civil rights liberalism. It wasn't called civil rights liberalism at that time because it wasn't, you know, liberalism had nothing to do with it. But by bringing it into the pundit coalition, he argues, it created modern liberalism as an ideology, or began to create it. But a couple of other things that were going on. Another student from UCLA, Chris Baylor, he's on the job market. You can hire him here at Case if you want to next year. Is looking at another dimension of it. His argument is first to the party. He looks at the activities of the interest groups themselves. So he's looking at in particular unions and African Americans in the 1930s. Up until the Wagner Act in 1935, which legalized union activity and made it illegal for employers to fire workers when they struck, up until the Wagner Act, blacks and unions had been enemies. The unions would not allow whites into the unions, and then the blacks were the strike breakers for the white unions. So those guys didn't like each other. With the passage of the Wagner Act, blacks were kind of getting into trouble. They weren't going to be strike breakers anymore because it wasn't going to be allowed by the Wagner Act. And so they had a reason to want to make peace with the unions. And the unions were the CIO in particular, which was led by pretty much socialists at that time, had the idea that they wanted to make the New Deal permanent. They wanted an industrial policy in the federal government that would stimulate the economy when the economy was weak and provide a full employment economy, kind of on the lines of Sweden. And they wanted the Democratic Party to stand for that, but they knew that with the White South and the Democratic Party, they didn't have a chance. So they were looking to bring more bodies, more voters into the Democratic Party, and they saw if we make friends with the blacks and they'll support our agenda and we'll support their agenda, we can take over the Democratic Party from the White South. And the two groups got together, they talked to each other, they began supporting each other's programs, they came into the Democratic Party, and a key event, some of you people here I'm sure remember this, was the 1948 Democratic Convention, where the unions in particular spearheaded a civil rights plank, a liberal civil rights plank, which caused the White South to bolt the Democratic Party. And so Strom Thurmond formed the Dixiecrat Party, and their purpose was to show the Democratic Party that they couldn't win without the South. But Truman did win, and so they wound up making the opposite point, which was that the party could win without the South. From that time on, the South was kind of began migrating to the right. But a particular part of this that I want to, I think this is an interesting story. From 1948 on, it was clear to any ambitious politician in the Democratic Party that if he wanted to become president, he had to be liberal on race. No, 1948 showed that you could not soft pedal race anymore. And Lyndon Johnson from Texas was nothing if not an ambitious politician, and he changed his spots and became an active exponent of civil rights. And in 1957, passed the Civil Rights Act, and he got his white Southern senator friends to go along on the argument that Lyndon Johnson told his white Southern senator friends, you have to let me have a Civil Rights Act so the Democratic Party will nominate me for president, because if they don't nominate me, they're going to nominate Hubert, that's Hubert H. Humphrey, racial liberal from Minnesota. And there's two biographies of Johnson that make this point very clear. Yes, the white Southerners agreed, we gotta nominate Lyndon and not Hubert for president. Kennedy got that nomination, but Johnson was his vice president. And the motive was, at the heart of our theory, he wanted to be nominated. He knew who you had to please to be nominated, and once those people made clear that they were going to be racial liberals, then all other candidates had to be racial liberals. And so that's our argument for how that changed. During this period of the 1950s, and again, I know that some in my audience will remember this, there was a time when liberals said that they weren't very good Democrats, they were liberals, because there was a difference between liberalism and the Democratic Party in the 1950s and the 1940s. And then eventually the White South got booted out or left the Democratic Party over this, by the 1960s. They were leaving it. And so then liberalism became, the liberal ideologues or the liberal activists took over the Democratic Party on behalf of their new ideology. And that's our general argument about party and ideology, that an ideology is an ideology, that second line there, an ideology is a coalition of policy demanders managed by the webmaster, which results in an agenda. So webmaster is kind of a joke. I mean like the pundits and the activists. So an ideology is a coalition of policy demanders, blacks, unions, rights, other people who want their certain things out of the government, a coalition managed by pundits and activists, and it results in an agenda. So a liberalism is an agenda managed by anybody in a national conversation, which could include groups and pundits. So the ideology is created in a national coalition outside the halls of Congress, outside the halls of government. I said, how does a coalition form outside of the halls of government? A big national coalition starts talking to each other and a consensus forms, driven maybe by the activist groups, as Chris Baylor said, or maybe by the pundits, as Hans Noel says in Coalition Merchants, or maybe by both. A new ideological group forms out in the public, and then if you're an ideology and you've got an agenda, what are you going to want to do? You're going to want to take over a party. And that's what liberalism managed to do, was to take over the party and remake the Democratic Party in its image. And there are a number of other cases in American politics where groups have tried to do this. Most recently, the Tea Party. The Tea Party is an ideology that has a little bit of a different flavor from conservatism. It's more anti-immigrant, and it's actually anti-Wall Street, which is a big part of conservatism. And they, some of their people were pretty full of themselves, and the Tea Party was going to take over the Republican Party. That was their goal, and to make it over in their image, just as the liberals had succeeded in doing. They probably aren't going to succeed in doing that. They're going to remain just one of the groups in the Republican Party. But that's a recent example of how ideology organizes people to take over a party. You can't, if you have a new policy demand, just kind of show up at a party meeting and say, hey, let's be for civil rights in the South. You got to fight your way in. And you got to be organized, and it's ideology that provides the organization for people to organize outside the party and then go into the party to take it over. Yes?
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with your basic thesis. I would take some issue with your time frame. There were more Republican senators who voted for the Civil Rights Act in 1964 than there were Democratic senators. I participated in the Civil Rights Movement. One of our main partners was the unions. All of the AFL unions were Lily White in the middle 60s. So obviously there was that change. A lot of that change took place with Nixon and the move to the more racist South. 60s, presidential politics changed, but certainly not congressional politics at that particular point in time. The Democratic Party was still heavily senatorially from the South, and Lyndon Johnson had a terrible time with the Southern Senators who voted against a lot of things, and certainly civil rights during that period of time. So I guess with that, my question is, how much are parties really a moving target? I mean, maybe they change slowly, but do they continue to change? At the present time, they're very ideologically in opposition to each other, quite clearly. But is that likely to continue, or do you see other interest groups coming along maybe influence both of the parties in different ways? Because there are certainly different parties now than they were in the 60s, and there are different parties in the 60s than they were in the 30s.
Excuse me. I'd like to just make a comment. One, when we do questions, we're going to try to record them on the microphone. Wasn't able to do this here. Second is, I'm going to restate Professor Hawkenstaff's question briefly.
All right. Well, I was going to answer it.
Okay. So, well, you will answer. If you're close to finish, I'd like to ask Professor Buechler to make a few comments, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, fine. So, all right. So Professor Zeller will answer the question.
So first of all, on the Republicans, the Republicans were not anti-civil rights, but they were not pro-civil rights either. They had been the party of Lincoln for a long time in name only. And a good deal of their support for the civil rights was, in my opinion, it was a freebie to make mischief, free vote to make mischief in the Democratic coalition. So it is true that they voted for it more than Southern Democrats for sure. As far as the dynamics between the unions and the civil rights groups, the AFL was the more conservative union, but the CIO was the leader here, and it was also in a fight. The CIO was trying to outmaneuver the AFL. And the leadership of the CIO in particular was very strongly committed to civil rights and had successfully maneuvered the AFL to not oppose it. So that there was a complex dynamic here, but I'm claiming that liberalism as an agenda had taken over the Democratic Party, had succeeded in capturing the high ground in the Democratic Party, especially as regards presidential nominations. That's what I was stressing. It was a long time before after the Civil Rights Act, then some of those Southern conservative senators began to be in trouble at home. So I think my story goes through. There's more details, as you pointed out. I've got a big overview, and I'm trying to summarize things here. As to parties as a moving target, yes, it's always change. But the claim is that to understand this change, you want to look at nomination politics and how groups get themselves into nomination politics. That's the general claim. And I could talk about some of the further changes. I did mention the Tea Party, but I would have liked to talk about the social conservatives and how they came into the Republican Party. They fought their way in. And I can tell stories about that at the stage of nominations. So let me just, I'm going to finish. I just want to summarize that play, that, I'd say a little bit more about that slide, and then I have that. What do we think about the normative properties, and then I'll be done, and that shouldn't be too much longer. So an ideology is a coalition of policy demanders managed by a large national conversation. And those ideological coalitions can be quite powerful. What's the organization? It's just a bunch of people committed to the same ideas and angry about it. And that can be a tremendous force, and it's kind of interesting that it can form just out in the society. A party then, and I've tried to state the party definition in a parallel way, a party is a coalition of policy demanders managed by politicians, not a national conversation, which results in the nomination and election of office holders committed to the coalition agenda. And so the activists and the interest groups are creating the ideology, and then the ideology takes over the party. So these are two very closely related concepts. Normative properties. So I said I actually should have gone back and changed my slide where I said this view of parties cannot be reconciled in a way with democracy. It can be, actually. The nature of politics is that there are a lot of people who want things strongly, and they don't necessarily want the same things. One person is for abortion but doesn't care about regulation. Somebody cares about regulation of business but not abortion. Somebody cares about guns or Western lands, but not about the other two things. The nature of politics, I would say, this is following E.E. Schnapschneider, the nature of politics is a lot of unorganized demands. But none of these unorganized demands is strong enough to take over the government by itself. Even the biggest of these intense policy demanding groups, say big business, or a group of people who used to call themselves the moral majority, are not near a majority. There's no group that's near a majority. So they have to form coalitions. And the people who tend to be active in forming these coalitions are what I call the intense policy demanders, the people who are just for some reason strongly committed to one of the or another of these elements. And how do the coalitions form? The coalitions, the good people gather in coalitions together, not because they want the same things, but just because they don't step on each other's toes. The pro-life people, they want abortion banned, they don't have strong feelings about government. About the role of government in business. And the business people have their strong feelings. So they don't step on each other's toes. As an example of people who did step on each other's toes, when the CIO in the 1930s and 40s got this idea of an industrial policy for the country on managing the economy in a full employment economy and so forth, they saw the White South as not a very suitable coalition partner. And when African Americans started coming into the Northern Democratic Party, they really did not like being in the party, in the same party with the White South, and the White South didn't like them either, because they had demands that just were directly opposed. So that was not a coalition that was going to survive. It was going to fly apart, and so the White South left. We're effectively outmaneuvered, starting in 1948. So what are the normative properties of this coalition? Well, in a country where we all have different demands, while we all like to be able to set the agenda, I am pro-life, but I am anti-Iraq war, and I do believe in global warming, but we'd all like to write the ticket for the government. But there's only two parties. And so these different demands that people have got to be organized in some way. And the parties' coalitions are the form of that organization. And some of the people who are active in politics are quite conscious that, okay, I am in this coalition because I believe in this, and those other people are just kind of irritating, but I need them to be part of a majority so that I can get control of the government, so that I can have my piece of the government as part of a coalition. And people, after they've been in a coalition for a while, start to take the attitude that the enemy of my friend is my enemy too, and they begin to be partisan about it, and all of the people who are fighting side by side begin to hate all of the people on the other side. And so you get people taking up each other's positions, even if it wasn't the thing that they originally cared about the most. So in our view, if that happens, it's really hard for me to, I know you're going to ask questions, and I'm going to say, I got to end. So that's not such a bad thing. I mean, we can't have the ideal thing where there's a natural organization to things. I don't think there is a natural organization to things. The way these things are organized changes across time. They have to be socially constructed. And then people can vote for the coalition that is the strongest on the thing that they care most about. And when the politicians elected from that coalition get into office, they will fight for those things and they will do those things whether most voters want them or not. So you'll have the Democratic coalition fighting for civil rights for African Americans when it's not completely clear that all Americans want that, but the Democratic Party wants that and it's the majority right now. Or the Republicans are going to cut taxes. They believe very strongly in that. It's not clear that all Americans want that, but that's what they want. And they won the election, and so they're going to do that. And it's not ideal that happens, but these are the people who pay the price of organizing the coalitions, and the return that they get on that is that this discretion of the government they get to use on behalf of their intense policy demands. And just so, and some of these intense policy demands, even if they're not the ones we like, we have to respect that they are other people's intense policy demands, and we can hope that maybe in the end that nobody's going to be able to keep their own intense policy demands as the policies of the government against a strong and caring majority of the public, and that mostly these people are going to be getting their way on things that they want a lot and the public doesn't care about as much. And maybe over the long run, these guys will provide a little bit of morality to our politics that might otherwise lack it, and push things off the off dead center on things that are going to in the long run be important, even if and we're all going to agree with, even if a majority of the public wouldn't on its own have gotten the gumption to get up and fight for them. So you can construct a morally, some elements of a morally pleasing argument out of these intense policy demanders who organize to capture the government on behalf of their demands. So.
Thank you very much, Professor Zeller. As a I knew that there would be a lot in this talk that was original and really striking for those of us who studied the political process. I know people have questions, but I thought it would be really interesting to give Professor Justin Buechler a first shot at commenting. And one of the reasons for this is that he also is a remarkably original scholar, who thinks very hard about how the election process really works. He recently published a groundbreaking book called "Hiring and Firing Public Officials," sort of rethinking, compared to the regular literature, exactly what's actually going on in elections. And he also, ultimately in the line of work that Anthony Downs began with in political science, has looked at this question, is looking right now at the question of what is the linkage between notions of the sort of political dynamic within the legislature and the political dynamic within the elections. I just want to make one comment about how original what we just heard was. Ideology is always talked about as ideas, not as people. Right? We don't talk about an ideology as a coalition. We talk about ideology as thoughts. And to talk about it as a coalition of people is really a neat twist for thinking about how the politics works. So that's my comment. That's what you'll get from me. Professor Buechler.
Thank you. I'm actually just going to follow up quickly on something Joe just said. The idea that ideology is socially constructed, I think, is actually very important and sort of missed but easily accepted within the literature on ideology based on a relatively simple observation, which is that there are lots of different ideologies, sets of ideas that we could construct. And a fundamental question is, why do we observe the sets that we observe when there are so many other sets that could be observed? And one answer, I think an important answer, is that they're socially constructed. I actually came from a conference last week in which I had the benefit of listening to Hans Knoll give the paper to which John kept referring in his presentation. I'm actually already in this mindset. But I want to talk about a couple of ideas just very quickly. I want to leave time for questions because I'd rather listen to John speak than listen to myself speak. The basic observation that I want to bring up, which I think is important and absolutely critical for the arguments that John is proposing here, is an observation that people frequently miss. So we talk about politicians as though they are purely electorally motivated and they will take whatever positions are politically convenient at the time. And actually, most of the research on what politicians do suggests that that isn't the case. An important finding, or at least an empirical finding that I consider very important, that I think is important for this argument, which is, what happens when members of Congress and other elected officials decide to retire? Does their behavior in office change? The answer is no, not very much. If that's the case, that suggests that most of what they're doing throughout their term in office is pretty much sincere. Now, what that also means is, if you want to influence policy by pressuring people in office, you're going to have a very difficult time doing that. So it's important to come up with a model that explains partisanship in a way that does not rely on elected officials being pressured. And that's exactly what this model does. So what the model that we've just seen does is it says that party activists manage to control the policymaking process and the party itself, not by pressuring people, but by controlling the nomination process. They get their way by making sure that the people who get the nominations are the people who are already true believers, who are in fact themselves activists. That way you don't have to pressure them to do anything they don't want to do, because what they want to do is what the activists want to do, because they're activists. This is an important finding that's missed by a lot of the literature on parties and on Congress in general. But this does bring up a couple of questions. One, which is absolutely central, which John hinted at a bunch of times, which I think is really important, is that we still don't really have a good handle on the mechanism of control of the nomination process. This is something that John and his co-authors have been struggling with for a while. And one of the problems is we do frequently observe elections in which party activists fail to get the nominees that they want. So right now, the Republican nomination for the presidency, party elected officials, or party officials, party activists seem to have gotten the candidate that they want. given the rather limited pool that they had. But if we look at past nominations, they frequently get candidates that they don't necessarily like. 2008 was sort of a bad year for this model. In general, Republican activists, the party activists, did not like John McCain. So the fact that John McCain got the nomination is a challenge to this type of model. So we don't really have a handle on this process. But there's something else going on here, which is this problem of coordination. So essentially what the argument is that party opinion leaders managed to create some sort of consensus among the activists, among different interest groups that constitute the party. Well, the problem is, how do you get that consensus? Because there are lots of times when opinion leaders will try to create some sort of consensus within a party. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. To see an example of it working very quickly, think about healthcare, think about the individual mandate. So the individual mandate used to be the kind of thing that a lot of conservative activists would like. It sort of came out of the Heritage Foundation. Maybe Joe wants to talk about this. But this used to be the kind of thing that Republican activists were really unified around. And then something happened and they all sort of turned on a dime. Somebody said, hey, you know what, maybe we should argue that this is actually unconstitutional. And the entire party apparatus turns on a dime. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes there are opinion leaders. I think the type of person that Hans Noll would focus on in modern politics for the Republican Party might be someone like George Will. So George Will every once in a while goes back to the idea that maybe marijuana should be legalized, and he tries to push this idea within Republican circles and try to get conservative activists to think that this is how they should think, and he tends to fail. Sometimes this process works, sometimes it doesn't. And if that's the case, then one of the analytic challenges for this model is to figure out why does it work sometimes and why does it fail other times. However, I do think there is something to this. However, I don't think it's necessarily the case that sort of opinion leaders within the party manage to do this, but there is something to the internal dialogue within a party, and there is something, I think, to the insularity of dialogue within a party. So if we look at polarization among elected officials, one of the other important empirical points that people generally miss is that the period of depolarization following World War II is the historical anomaly. If we look at the broad history of Congress, it is usually polarized. Elected officials are normally polarized. So if we look at the post-World War II period as an anomaly, then we have to figure out what was different about that period and what is the same now as it was in other times in history. And I think there is something to the insularity of political dialogue. So if we look at what parties used to do, they used to do things like run their own newspapers. The idea of an independent newspaper that was not a part of a political party in the 1800s, it wouldn't have made any sense. They were party creations. All political dialogue was internal to the party. So it makes perfect sense that the parties would be unified. We have something more like that now. In fact, when did this start? Well, you could argue that this started particularly for the Republican Party in the 1970s when we started getting the think tanks popping up all over the place, creating an internal dialogue that became more unified. There is something to the internal dialogue within a party that is not necessarily driven by specific opinion leaders, but I do think this is an important piece of what's going on. And the other important point that I want to remind everyone again about is the point that I started this with, which is that most politicians behave sincerely. So what is going on with these internal dialogues is they are affecting what the politicians themselves think. And I agree substantively with most of the argument here. I'm not entirely sold on the mechanism of controlling the nominations. But again, as John said, they don't really have a handle on that. And I think this is the big challenge for the model. But since we don't really understand the nomination process anyway, for whatever reason, I don't know.
Thank you very much, Justin. And now we'll move to some questions. This gentleman first.
Well, nothing was said about the media. And when I think about one of the things that our speaker spoke about, how the public is blind to a lot of different issues, seems to me there's a big media war going on. One side of the media saying things that they think should be the issues that everybody focuses on, the other side picking a different set of issues because they want to get they have their bias. And so it seems to me that the media has to come into this equation now more than ever before, because it didn't used to be, you know, right in front of everybody 24 hours a day with arguments for and against many issues, which are vying to become the key issue for why you should or shouldn't elect a particular person.
I'm sorry, I have to disagree on that one. It's just my opinion, but I think that the media are overrated as a force in American politics. I don't think that they're in a market. They're more, I think, responsive to public. They're responsive to public opinion more often than they lead them because they are in a market. My personal biography, professional biography, I should say, I started with studying public opinion, and I decided, based partly on the size of this blind spot that I was describing, that to understand what was happening in American politics, didn't want to have a primary focus on public opinion. Again, public opinion does create constraints on the public, and probably it's very difficult to tell what those constraints are, because the things that the public really doesn't want, the politicians don't do. And so there might be a whole lot of influence that's invisible that way. But I don't think that's a media phenomenon. For the part of what happens that the public isn't putting firm boundaries on, after I wrote my first book on Nature and Origins of Mass Opinion, which is my best-known book, I wrote a book on media politics. And I got to the end of that book, and I started writing, and it was... It was a very successful book. If you Google it, you'll see it has hundreds or maybe thousands of hits. It was never published. And that reason for that was I came to the end of it, and I was trying to say how I thought the media mattered, and I just couldn't find any way that it mattered, that I was convinced that it really mattered. I'm not saying that, again, that it never matters for anything, but it just didn't seem to be the driving force. And at that time, that was the late 90s, what the main literature on presidential nominations was saying was that media momentum drove nominations. And you may remember hearing that it was kind of in the media for a while, that media momentum drove nominations. And so I looked at the list of recent nominees, you know, Bob Dole and George W. Bush and Al Gore. It just didn't seem like these guys were like media-driven politicians, or Michael Dukakis. Or even Bill Clinton was more nearly destroyed by the media than made by the media, because he had his problems with his past right in the middle of the Republican primary of the primary process. So it didn't look to me like they were driving it, and it looked to me like the inside party players were winning. And so I began thinking about that, and these four people who are then graduate students at UCLA, and I would begin working on this party's project, and we did something on presidential nominations, and we made a general argument about the role of parties, of groups in politics. And I should say David Carroll was, I haven't mentioned his name, it was on the, one of the slides, but he was the one who first said it's the groups. And we tried a lot of different things, and he said, no, it's the groups. And so that's where that idea came from, and we've been building that into things. And we haven't got it all figured out. I think David still doesn't believe in ideology, and Hans thinks that the pundits are more important than the rest of us do. So that's a good collaboration where we're arguing with one another. But the media, I think we just, you know, I'm not saying it counts for nothing. I mean, they're out there. They can sometimes be influential for things. But the people who can capture the politicians, I think that's the linchpin. And then those politicians, people who are committed to the party program, and maneuver in a pretty fluid political system on behalf of the elements of the party program, and with the voters able to monitor them sometimes, but not always. That to me is the dynamics. And the media sometimes are important. I could give a talk on it, but I wouldn't make them the first force.
But I moved to look at the issue of putting pundits at the front of the line in terms of helping to form coalitions and aggregate ideas. And where would they be without the media? They need, and Rush Limbaugh needs radio. George Will needs his column, and so forth. So I can't reject media so completely as you do?
Well, I don't really reject it. I just don't see it. I see what you can't see, and I'm really consumed by it. These conversations between the candidates and their supporters. I can't see them, but in my mind, I think that's really important. One way where the media is important, but I think not as a fundamental driver of politics, is that Rush Limbaugh and Fox News and MSNBC, to some extent, they are getting better at getting that message out there, that ideological message out there. So the voters are more polarized on the ideological message, somewhat more polarized on the ideological message than they have been, than they were in the 1950s when we didn't have such compelling presentations of the party positions. I mean, there's a lot of soft news that carries ideological partisan messages, and it's a democratizing influence. One of my colleagues from UCLA, who's moved on to Harvard, actually, Matt Baum, was the first one to propose the idea that the soft media were becoming carriers of news in the same way that maybe a big supermarket carries some light bulbs and some pliers and maybe some socks. So it just can become a one-stop store. And I think that some of the entertainment soft news stuff, it's mostly about entertainment, but if there's a war going on, they might show some movie star guy as he's being drafted and taken off to or going off to Iraq. And so that the messages are getting out, they're penetrating further down to people who are not paying as much attention. But I don't think so they're more polarized, but I don't think that those opinions that are being formed are really driving politics. I think they're reflecting politics. But again, the media can be important, so let me think. I have to think of a time now when I think that the media were originally important. I think on civil rights they were pretty important in the 50s and 60s, 40s, 50s and 60s, that the national media were extremely pro-civil rights, and I think that they have probably been a force, including entertainment politics, on gay rights more recently. They popularized that idea before politicians were willing to take it on. So that's important. That's important. Sometimes the journalists get excited about things that I think that as a small example, just before the vote on President Obama's on the Obamacare program, President Obama's health care program, there was a story in California about out of California that became national about how an insurance company was, quadrupling the rates or something like that. So just on the eve of the vote, there was a very bad piece of news, and the journalists played it up a lot because it had relevance to the vote, and it might have actually had a little bit of influence right there. But a much bigger factor was that Ted Kennedy died and was replaced by a Republican, and so that the Democrats didn't have 60 votes anymore. I mean, having 60 votes in the Senate was what it was about, much more than how the media were covering it. With my sense.
I was surprised that you didn't mention money very much in your talk. And it seems to me that, especially in the Republican primaries, we saw the influence of money and the effect of the negative campaigning and the fact that the front runner changed so much because everybody ganged up against the front runner with a bunch of negative advertising, and it seemed to work, unfortunately.
Well, money, I think, is a more important force than the media, and in the post-Citizens United era, it might become more important than it has been. However, money is not really separate from activists and ideology. I see it as part of the same thing. And I think that that boots on the ground activist politics and just people's conversations with one another reflecting ideology are probably a more important force. One of my favorite candidates is Rudy Giuliani, who was in 2008 the media politics guy. He had grabbed the megaphone at the time of 9/11. He was the poll front runner, he was the money front runner through most of 2008, and he was going to compete in Iowa in the Iowa caucuses, and he couldn't get anybody to work for him. And in Iowa, that's a big problem. And he just withdrew from Iowa. Here's another guy, like I said, Romney. He's from New York. He was a very good politician, but he, you know, charismatic, able to organize a campaign, be forceful, not put his foot in his mouth. He was a very good politician, very effective politician, but he had a bunch of baggage from being the mayor of New York. And so he went to Iowa, and nobody would work for him. And so he just withdrew. He says, okay, I'm going to go fight it out in New Hampshire, which is closer to what I care about, you know, to where I live, and it's not so much, it's an election, not a caucus, and I'll make my stand there. And he couldn't get anyone to work for him there. He had lots of money, but nobody would work for him, and he wound up making his stand in Florida, you know, several elections later, because nobody in the Republican Party would work for him. He could hire some people and buy some ads, but it wasn't a message that was going to sell in the critical early primary states. Iowa is strong for social conservatives, and New Hampshire is strong for economic conservatives. And the activists in those states would not work for the man because, despite his money, despite his poll, his initial, and he was a national poll leader. Did I say that? If people say who you want for president, people don't know too much. Giuliani was the most famous guy. When it came down to these fairly low turnout, activist and dominated events, and where ideology and ideological purity is important, money couldn't buy him the election. A lot of people, the history of presidential nominations is littered with fat cats who spent their own money and couldn't get anywhere. The first big one was John Conley in 1980, and then Steve Forbes spent a lot of his money twice and got nowhere. Money's important. But I don't think it's the, it's definitely important, but I don't think it's the main driver. If you want to read a really, really interesting article on money, Ezra Klein in the New York Review of Books, just Google that, and he had a review of some books on money and politics. What his thesis was that money buys little pieces of policy. It buys a regulation that you want. It doesn't buy things that are fought out in the open. That's his thesis, and I think it's a good one. But money is always important, but it's not the only thing, and it's not independent of these other forces.
Can you say a little then about this recent Republican nomination process? It is commonly said that Romney had the money to essentially rubbish his opponents, and that his advantage in money helped him, you know, greatly. On the other hand, an alternative interpretation is that when it came down to it, Romney was the least unacceptable of the bunch, and that in your framework, a larger portion of the Republican activist coalition was willing to back him than to back the other guys. So what's your feeling about how this thinking applies to the current Republican nomination contest?
Well, I agree with what you said. I mean, the second part of it especially, that he had the most money. He had the most money because he was the candidate who was the best bet to go the distance for the party. And then the money had some, it helped him out. It helped him out in a lot of critical primaries, his ability to outspend the other candidates. But Santorum could have beat him in Wisconsin and Illinois. I guess Wisconsin was kind of late, but Illinois and Michigan. So his money was important there. But it was important because he was the best candidate in the long run. It was important on the margin because he was the insider choice, and there was no other candidate who was strong enough to attract enough money. And some Post United Super PAC guys were giving money to Gingrich and Santorum, and they just lost their money. And that typically happens. That I would say is the main story. When somebody either has a lot of money or donates a lot of money to somebody who's not the consensus candidate, they get a little bit for their money, but mostly they lose their money.
One other follow-up. It seems to me presidential nominations are very different from congressional nominations. They have so many stages. Momentum may be overstated, but it's just a very much more complicated situation. And it would seem to me that during the 2012 campaign, there were a series of state contests. You mentioned Michigan Illinois, Ohio for sure. Well, you can imagine with a better campaign, it's not really a matter of money, that Rick Santorum would have won those states. And so I guess the question is there in presidential nominations, not congressional nominations, a certain amount of randomness factor here? I mean, yes, the coalitions, you can say Romney had more support from the various interest groups in the Republican coalition, maybe, but, 3 points here, 2 points here, 3 points there, and Santorum has a bunch of big wins in the North, in the Midwestern states, and maybe it looks different, or maybe not. I guess that's my question.
Yes, randomness is a big factor. A particular state where a candidate happens to be popular or unpopular, or I would say a great examples of this were came up in the South Carolina primary to the advantage of Newt Gingrich, one of them was somebody had put out some dirt on his wife, and the other one was when that guy from Fox News, Juan Williams, asked him this question that enabled, threw up the softball that Gingrich was able to hit out of the park, and that guy was nobody until he answered those questions on national TV, and he shot to the top of the pack, and that was a random event. And if you run the thing over again, it wouldn't have happened that way. And so randomness is a big factor in this. And that, though, is why we argue that parties forming a united front behind these guys and making sure they have organization and money and staff to deal smartly and effectively with the things that come up is so important, because the guy who's supposed to win, who's the best person fundamentally, could get blown away by a random event. You could set off a chain of momentum and have Jimmy Carter be your nominee. And our argument, in fact, in the book was that Jimmy Carter was an example of a guy who won sort of by random factors, because the other candidates weren't organized to respond effectively to the random events that favored him. So randomness is big, and the party's organized to keep that factor down. You might say, well, if Romney is the best candidate, why do they have to do anything? He's just going to win. And the answer is because even the best candidate might not win without making a full and effective effort. So randomness is a real big deal. And sometimes randomness is going to get the upper hand.
On that happy note about American politics, randomness getting the upper hand, I might call it a happy note because it may beat some of the alternatives. I would like to thank you all for coming. I'd like to thank Professor Buechler for his comments. And I'd especially like to thank Professor John Zeller for giving this extremely interesting talk today.